Hey, hey, everybody. Welcome to the Taboo Trades Podcast, a show about stuff we aren't supposed to sell, but do anyway. I'm your host, Kim Kravick. All right. So thank you for being here today, Peter Jaworski, a philosopher by training, an associate teaching professor in strategy, ethics, economics, and public policy at Georgetown University's McDonough School of Business, an expert in plasma donation who has written a lot about it, and also has been involved in a variety of sort of legal changes and political debates, especially in Canada, surrounding paid plasma donation that hopefully we will talk a little bit about today. So thank you, Peter, for doing this. It's good to see you.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me. I appreciate you letting me talk to your students about this issue.
Yeah, well, students and hopefully others, right? Because we're putting this out into the world. So, so hopefully others as well. Okay, so can we just start, if you don't mind, with some basic information about plasma? Because it's not an obvious thing to people sort of why we have a shortage of plasma, or why there's an issue about providing sufficient amounts of plasma. So why do we need plasma? In other words, why are we even having this discussion?
Okay, so I bought these on eBay, so I want to show you. These are all the components of your blood. Okay, this is white cells. These are your white cells. These are your red cells, right? This is what makes your blood red, right? So this is for the law students, right?
This is brilliant. I love it.
Yeah, good. These are your platelets, okay? And then this is plasma, right? And then this is a protein found in your plasma called an antibody or an immune globulin. So we'll be talking about these two things. So the white blood cells and the platelets, they make up about 1% of the volume of like the whole blood in your veins, okay? Interestingly, they're called a Buffy layer, right? So if you watch Buffy the Vampire Slayer, yeah. I believe that's why her name is Buffy. That's
My
own theory. I don't know if that's true. Yes. Then 45% of your blood are these red cells, and then the remainder, 55%, is plasma. And plasma is this straw-colored liquid. It's like yellow. It's mostly water, but it also contains these like really important proteins. And I just have this guy here. This is immune globulin, right? Or an antibody. That's one of the proteins that float around in your plasma. But there's also albumin that is in your plasma. That's a different protein, and a variety of different clotting factors, right? Okay. Those three different types of proteins, there's also other proteins that are important as well. What we do is we ask people to donate plasma, and there's two different ways to get at plasma, which I'll get to in a second. And then we separate out these individual proteins, and we create plasma-derived medicinal products from those proteins. Those proteins are useful against a number of different problems or diseases that people might have. Some people can't produce their own antibodies, and so they rely on intravenous or subcutaneous immune globulin infusions, like regular infusions, and that allows them to go about their day. For most of us, if we have severe burns or we have some kind of trauma, that's when albumin is useful. And then there are people who have rare blood disorders. The most famous one, I guess, would be hemophilia, but also things like von Willebrand disease. It's like when your blood has trouble clotting, or your blood doesn't clot at all, and then we use clotting factors to help with that.
Okay.
Now, there are like...
So this is something that you actually mentioned in the appendix to your article that people are often confused about, and that seems right to me. And I myself have always had questions about this, which is, how much of the demand for plasma is then for these pharmaceuticals, if you will, that are made with the proteins versus, I guess, plasma transfusions? Is there a use for sort of whole plasma? And if so, like, what percentage is that? Do you know?
I don't know the exact percentage, Kim, but it's tiny.
It's tiny.
The amount of plasma that we need for transfusion is so small.
Okay, got it.
The overwhelming majority of the plasma that is used around the world is used for these therapies.
Okay, perfect. That's I wanted to know the answer to that. Okay, so I interrupted you. Sorry. Did you have more on the specifics of the proteins?
Yeah, so here's not about the proteins, but about the process whereby we get the plasma. So there are two major ways. One is called recovered. The other kind is called source plasma. Recovered plasma is you go in for a whole blood donation, and then we, after the fact, separate the plasma from the red and white blood cells and the platelets, okay? And then we can use the plasma that way. The second way is called source plasma, and I have another like visual example here. So this is a bottle used to collect source plasma, and on it, it indicates like different weights because people can donate more or less plasma depending on how much they weigh. Right. So just to give you a sense of how large this bottle is, it's huge, right? It's really large. Source plasma separates the plasma from the red and white blood cells, but it does that while you're sitting in a chair, and then it keeps the plasma and returns everything else back to you. Right. It takes your body about 24 hours to regenerate plasma, whereas by contrast, it takes your body about 56 days to regenerate the red and white blood cells and the platelets. So you can donate source plasma much more often in the United States than in Canada. You can do it twice a week with 48 hours in between donations. In Europe, it depends on which country in Europe, but it's basically once a week that you can donate. By contrast, you can donate whole blood once every 56 days, and that's true all around the world.
Okay. All right. So one thing, so let's follow up, I guess, on this discussion about the process, because my guess is that most of the people watching or listening to this have not donated plasma. Some will have, but probably most will not have, but probably a lot of them donated blood and probably they didn't get paid, or, you know, they maybe got a little gift card or something like that. So why is it then that we are not, I should preface this by saying that Nico Lechetra and Mario Machis, and they are also going to be guests on here. So in fact, we will talk about paying for blood, but what's different about these two processes that make the U.S., among other countries, mostly able to collect the amount of blood that it needs without paying for it, and not able to do that with respect for plasma?
Okay, so I should point out that like every once in a while, we do have shortages of like specific types of blood, and sometimes there are shortages of blood as well.
The reason countries, there are severe shortages, but yes.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, and the reason why we don't pay for blood is because in order to manufacture the therapies from plasma, we can do certain things to that plasma that we can't do for purposes of transfusion. That's true both for plasma and for blood. When we transfuse plasma or transfuse blood as a whole, we take all of it, we don't process it, right? We collect it, and then basically one-to-one, we transfuse it to another person. When we're making the therapies out of the plasma, we can do a number of things. For example, we can pasteurize or heat treat the plasma. And heat treatment is effective against viruses like HIV, for example. Okay, the most important stage in the process of purification and viral inactivation and removal is the use of solvents and detergents. So the same reason why like washing your hands with soap and water is effective against coronavirus is the same reason why that process is effective against hepatitis C, for example, hepatitis B, and a number of other viruses. These are viruses that have a lipid envelope, or they have like oil around them. And when you introduce soap, it breaks up that oily outer layer and exposes the vulnerable inside to attack, right? And so we kill those viruses in the process of making plasma therapies. But we can't use those steps for purposes of transfusion, right? And so that's why, by the way, we don't pay for blood. That's also why we don't pay for plasma for purposes of transfusion, but we do pay for plasma only if we're going to turn it into those therapies. How is it possible that the United States collects enough blood without payment? The answer is that the volume of blood that we need for transfusions has been decreasing significantly almost every single year through superior patient blood management. Right? We don't need a unit of blood at every single surgery anymore.
Okay.
So the demand has decreased.
Okay. So part of it is that we don't need as much blood as we need for plasma. And part of it is that we can treat plasma in ways that we can't treat blood that makes it safer, regardless of the source. Is that reasonably close?
Regardless of
regardless. Yes. Maybe that's an overstatement. Yeah. Okay.
That makes it strong. We do have
restrictions. Yes. But it eliminates some of our worries about certain types of bloodborne illnesses in particular that we worry about with respect to blood for transfusion purposes. Is that better? Okay. Okay, good. I forgot, but since you brought up coronavirus, I wanted to get you to speak briefly about the new, what I assume is a new use of plasma for treating coronavirus patients now. Can you say something about that? I mean, I have a friend, a co-author, who is donating his, so.
Are you allowed to say the co-author's name?
Al Roth. He publicly put it on his blog, so yeah.
Yes.
But Al has been donated his, yeah, so.
And
others, yeah.
Yeah, so here's what we know about convalescent plasma. It's a promising treatment, transfusing people who currently have coronavirus with the plasma of someone who has recovered from coronavirus. The reason why it works, if it works, is because the plasma of the people who have recovered from coronavirus contains the antibodies against coronavirus, amongst all the other proteins that are inside of that plasma. And we hope, and we have some good reason to believe, that that's going to be effective at least for a certain number of people, right? So we would transfuse that convalescent plasma. Interestingly, the pharmaceutical companies that manufacture plasma-derived medicinal products, they are also working on a therapy against coronavirus as well. And it's the same principle. They want to isolate the specific antibody against coronavirus. They want to concentrate that and then create this, it's also experimental at this point, but a treatment. So one interesting issue is that in order to transfuse people with convalescent plasma, we can't pay the donor. Mm-hmm. So Al Roth, for example, he is not paid for his plasma donation because they're using his plasma to transfuse into people who have coronavirus right now. However, the plasma companies are paying people, and they're paying people more for this specialty type of plasma. So the numbers that I've heard, they range from like $100 to $200 per donation.
As
so there
is
an
to
interesting
roughly 50 for regular.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
It's like $30 to $50 in the United States would be the average.
Would be the average. Okay. All right. One of the things I wanted to talk to you about are safety issues. I mean, as you know, there are a variety of arguments that are put forward against paying plasma donors, but one of the ones that is front and center has to do with safety. And I guess we could think about safety on two fronts, right? One being the safety of the plasma supply. Do we worry that paid donors are giving us unsafe plasma? That is an argument that is frequently raised. And then the other is safety to donors, which we can talk about as well. I mean, maybe we should start with the second one, because I have a feeling we're going to dispense with the first one pretty quickly. But safety to donors seems worth talking about, right? And so in your paper, I actually pulled this quote just to play devil's advocate with you on page 25, where you say, remuneration demonstrably leads to higher donation frequencies per donor. And critics, of course, would say that that is a bad thing, right? That means that the profit imperative is encouraging plasma collectors to disregard donor safety in a way that wouldn't happen if we did not pay donors. And that right there is an argument against paying donors. So I have a feeling you have a response to that.
So I do. And so first, the average American plasma donor donates 21.4 times per year.
Okay.
That's the average. That's the majority of plasma donors will donate. It's about twice a month. Okay. At those rates, there is no evidence whatsoever that that's harmful to the donor.
Okay.
In fact, there have been two separate CIPLA studies that looked at high frequency donations. However, they only tested up to, I think it was 50 donations per year or 60 donations per year, right? And at those caps, it looks like there is no additional risk from donating that frequently. Now, typically there are tests for the level of proteins in your plasma that are done in the United States. Those tests are done more frequently in Germany than the United States. I do think that something that they should do in the United States is test for the presence of the important proteins more frequently.
Do we test it just not as often?
Yeah, I think in the United States, those protein levels are tested once every 2 to 3 months, whereas in Germany, it's done much more frequently. I think it's like once every 2 weeks or something like that.
And just to clarify for listeners, Germany pays plasma donors as well. Is that correct? Okay, right. So,
so there are five countries that pay.
Germany, the U.S., Austria?
Yeah. The Czech Republic or Czechia.
Okay.
Right, and Hungary. Those are the five.
Okay.
And together, they supply 89% of the entire world's plasma used to make these plasma therapies.
Right. Interesting.
At this point, it's probably closer to 90%.
Well, I think it's interesting what you said about Germany testing more frequently, right? Because, I mean, it's evidence that there are many market models. Right. I mean, there are different ways that one can structure a marketplace, either to protect donors or not protect donors. Germany has chosen, at least in this particular regard, to test donors more frequently, and therefore, one might argue, pay more attention to their safety and welfare, at least on this one metric, than in the U.S.
And I think I'd be prepared to say that that's true.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
But you know, now I'm done playing devil's advocate and I'm going to argue on your side.
Well, before you do, Kim, let me make what I think is the most powerful argument.
Okay. Do it.
On this one. And it has to do with legally, the United States and Canada now too permits up to 104 donations per year.
Okay.
So twice a week, every single week, you get up to 104 donations. In the United States, less than 1% of plasma donors donate at that frequency. So we're talking about a small number of people. However, those people are at the border between the United States and Mexico. So the donors are actually Mexicans who cross the border and sell their plasma regularly. Twice a week, every single week, and they're the ones that overwhelmingly give 104 times per year. CSL Plasma is an Australian company, and they are expanding, and a lot of their plasma centers are being located at the border. Okay. And the reason why Mexicans cross the border to do this so frequently is because $20 to $50 in the United States is like, okay, that's not bad. That's pretty good. You know, $300, $400 a month, that's okay. But in some cities in Mexico, you're talking about a middle-class income.
Yeah, right. That's amazing. And so have there been any studies on their health, on the health of this particular set of donors that are donating much more frequently or no?
No, not yet.
Not yet.
We have followed some of those donors. Nothing that rises to the level of a proper study. I'd like to see those done.
Yeah.
So that is actually the space in this entire debate that gives me a bit of pause. And you see something similar at the border between Austria and Slovakia. Slovakia is an interesting case because it's surrounded on three sides by countries that do pay for plasma. Uh-huh. And there are plenty of Slovaks that cross the border into Austria and sell their plasma there because of the relative difference in how far that money goes.
Right.
But in Austria, you can only donate, I think it's 50 to 60 times per year, not up to 104 times. So it's less of a concern there.
Right. So you may not know the laws of all the countries, but we just compared Germany and the U.S. Is your sense that the U.S. law on frequency of donation is the most lenient of the five countries that permit donation, or
If you include Canada, Canada actually very recently adopted the same frequency as the United States.
Okay.
I'm Canadian, by the way, so that's why I'm about to use we to refer to Canadians.
Sure.
But like, we used to allow once a week frequency, but we changed that in, I think it's April of this year, to match the American system.
Okay.
So I would like to know on what basis Health Canada, that's our regulatory body, why they changed to the American model, but I do trust Health Canada, so they probably know something that I don't know.
Right. Right. So, I mean, since you brought up Canada, I would like to talk about Canada a little bit. So I guess part of where I see these concerns about the safety of the plasma supply from paid donors is in Canada and in connection with the debates that has gone on. I mean, it's been very heated at various times for, has it been maybe 5 years? It's since the debate first became very heated about paid plasma.
So it started 8 years ago in 2012.
Okay. Time goes much faster for me than I think it is going these days. Okay. And so you'll have to inform me of this. It's hard to follow it sometimes as an outsider. I got the sense that there was some past scandal in Canada that people kept referencing. That really seemed to motivate critics of paid plasma. Do you know anything? Can you shed some light on that?
Yeah, so the scandal actually happened around the world. It's called the tainted blood scandal. It happened in the United States as well as in Canada and in the United Kingdom. They're going through, what's that called? They're doing like a, right now there's some government body that's looking into the 1980 scandal. So here's in brief what happened. There were blood products and blood that was purchased from the United States. And so a lot of the blood transfusions that were from the United States, they caused people to receive HIV. So in the 1980s, we didn't know about HIV. Mm-hmm. That was a brand new virus that hit. And so a lot of people contracted HIV from blood transfusions.
Mm-hmm.
However, a more sizable number of people were affected by use of plasma-derived medicinal therapies, namely a product called Factor VIII. Factor VIII, so hemophiliacs used Factor VIII in order to be able to live a normal life, and then they contracted hepatitis B and hepatitis C from the Factor VIII product. We found out afterwards, by the way, that the plasma was taken, it was paid plasma, but it was taken from primarily the Arkansas prison system, right? So most of the plasma used to manufacture Factor VIII products came out of the prison system, and in particular, the Arkansas prison system. And at the time, we didn't have the kinds of technologies, we didn't have the solvents and detergents and heat treatment until, so early on in the 80s, we didn't have it. By the mid-80s, we had it, but we didn't always use it. Right, so a lot of people, and we're talking about thousands. So in Canada, a country of back then it was like 28 million or 30 million people, something like 35,000 people were infected. Just about every single hemophiliac in Canada, in the United States, in the United Kingdom, and elsewhere contracted hepatitis B, hepatitis C, if they were using the Factor VIII product from the United States. Okay, as a consequence of this tainted blood scandal, there were inquiries all over the world, and one of the most significant inquiries all over the world was conducted in Canada. It's called the Creever Inquiry. They put Justice Horace Creever in charge of that. He was a Supreme Court justice in Canada. And he came up with a set of criteria to ensure that something like this doesn't happen again. And amongst the criteria was, one, we need one single national blood operator, right? That was one of, this actually generated the creation of Canadian Blood Services. The Canadian Red Cross, by the way, was kicked out of the country.
Oh, really?
Yes. So the Canadian Red Cross.
And that's the birth of CBS.
The birth of CBS happened after we kicked out Canadian Red Cross because part of the inquiry also, we discovered that people knew that some of these products were, and yet nevertheless allowed them. It's a huge scandal. The largest health-related scandal in Canadian history, right? So the Canadian Red Cross was kicked out. Canadian Blood Services took over. Quebec is always weird. Quebec created its own independent system. So in Quebec, it's Héma-Québec. In the rest of Canada, it's Canadian Blood Services.
Okay.
Canadian Red Cross was kicked out. So that was one recommendation. Another recommendation that opponents of paid plasma highlight is that, like, blood and plasma, regardless of what use you put it to, should not be paid for. We should only have unpaid. The other things, the things that people on the other side of this debate fail to mention is that Justice Creeper also recommended that we not import plasma therapies. And yet Canada continues to import plasma therapies from the United States primarily, where of course donors are paid.
Right. So that's actually the thing that always gets me about this debate. I mean, are people who raise that, are they uninformed? Do they not realize that they're buying their plasma from the U.S. where we pay donors? Or are they being disingenuous? You know, they know, but they think others won't know, and this is a good rhetorical device. Or is their concern something else and nobody's going to listen to the something else, so they jump on this bandwagon? I'm always puzzled by this argument.
Okay, if I have to guess as to, like, the motives of the people on the other side, but only because you're asking me and only because I have to, I would say that they're being disingenuous. Everybody is informed that, like, we get, by everybody, I mean everybody who is commenting about this publicly, everybody knows that we get our plasma therapies, almost all of them, from the United States, where donors are paid. However, the Canadian public, they're not really that aware. So you know, so we, people on the other side, continue to raise the issue of safety, which is a non-issue.
Yeah.
It's a non-issue. These plasma-derived medicinal products, we haven't had anything in over 25 years now. Not a single person has contracted any transfusion-transmissible infection from any of these products. That's an unbelievable safety track record, right? So they're perfectly safe, but the thought is that it's easier to convince people to be against paying for plasma domestically, that is within Canada, if you raise the specter of this tainted blood scandal and suggest that something similar might happen now. Something similar will not happen now, right? But, like, the vast majority of the Canadian public is not aware of that fact.
Right.
But I have to speculate as to their motives. But you'll notice that, like, their arguments have shifted over time. So back in 2014, the arguments were about safety primarily. Then a few years later, you know, because the CEO of Canadian Blood Services has repeatedly said
that it's
that
safe.
Therapies, that it's safe and that it's equally safe, that
what's
it's just as
again?
Safe. Graham Schur.
Right. Yes. He seems very sensible from what I've, on this issue anyway, from what I've read.
Yeah. When it comes to the safety, he definitely is.
Yeah.
But the argument has shifted to this concern about the impact on unpaid blood donations from the presence of paid plasma.
Oh,
or
okay.
Parallel paid plasma.
So they shifted from a safety argument to a crowding out argument. Is that essentially what has happened? Oh, okay. And so can we talk about that then? Explain the crowding out argument that they've shifted to.
So the intuitive claim is pretty simple, right? Suppose you had a choice. You can either give blood for free or you can get paid to donate plasma, which do you prefer? And actually, this is kind of funny because when I talk to people about it, most people say, well, I would want to be paid to donate plasma. I would give blood for free. That's what they'll say. But it's all these other people. Like me, I'm pure, I'm an altruist, right? It's just everybody else. But this is all I hear from everybody. Hardly anybody, well, some people have told me that, like, oh yeah, sure, I would sell my plasma rather than give blood away for free. That's the intuitive appeal of this argument.
Right.
And it just sort of makes sense. You get paid for one, not for the other. Most people are going to choose the paid option rather than the unpaid option, right? So that is basically the concern. That's the intuitive argument undergirding that particular
argument. Is it that intuitive, though? So, I mean, it does not seem intuitive to me, and I can't decide whether that's because I know too much or know too little, and it could be either one. But, I mean, they're two completely separate processes, right? You know, giving blood is, you know, you go to school one day and they're like, hey, come give blood. And, you know, all your friends are doing it. And so you go. Whereas donating plasma, my sense is I've never donated plasma, but my sense is that, you know, it takes more planning and they're going to do some tests and it's more time consuming and you're going to be tired afterwards, are you not? So it doesn't, they just don't strike me as being that, they don't strike me as being substitutes. But am I mistaken about that? Are they more similar than I realize?
I am glad that those are your intuitions, because your intuitions are exactly right and the intuitions of everybody else are exactly wrong.
I love
and
that.
It's partly a consequence of what you just said. It takes a lot longer to donate source plasma than it does to donate blood.
Right.
To donate blood, it takes, like, you can do it during your lunch break.
Right.
It's like
right.
30 minutes, 45 minutes, maybe an hour to donate right. blood. It takes 1.5 to 2 hours.
Right.
To give plasma.
Right.
That's sometimes even longer than that, right? Right. You're sitting in a chair and it's 40 minutes with a needle in your arm.
Right. Right. And this seems to mostly affect women. This is anecdote, by the way, just from discuss, because every year I ask my students, which of the things we're going to discuss for money have they done, right? And plasma is one that some people have. But a number of women were ruled ineligible because of, I guess, the body weight restrictions. So not everybody can give plasma. And it seems that women are excluded more than men. But, you know, I have a sample of, you know, 10. So is that,
yeah,
is
I mean,
that
you're right.
No?
Yes, that's right. It's also iron deficiency is more
right. would be more common in women. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, but it is a weight issue. So I think, I don't remember off the top of my head how much you have to weigh, but there's a lot of women who fall under the weight
yes.
restriction. The weight
yes.
requirement.
Yeah, some of my students did. At least that's the what they reported. Okay, so let's get back to the crowding out argument. I mean, presumably this is something we have data on, right? I mean, is the crowding out argument borne out by the data we have or not?
Okay, so I'm so glad you asked, because yes, we now have data, thanks to a paper that I wrote with my colleague William English, which looks at, like, actual data, not survey data, not aggregate country level data.
Yeah.
So before this paper that Bill English and I, Bill English, who's a Duke graduate, by the way.
I was going to say, I feel like I know him, but or have run into him. Yeah.
I've got my Georgetown basketball 1984.
I can't support you in that.
Okay. Well, I can't support you in your Duke basketball.
No, I actually can't either. I have to confess that I am a Tar Heel fan.
Whoa.
I know.
Well, we'll have to edit this.
We'll edit that out. Yeah, luckily there's editing.
So let me tell you the history. So here's the kind of evidence that we had in the past. We had an instance in Germany where there was, like, a paid blood center. So Germany does, in fact, pay for blood, right? But they have both systems. They pay for blood and they also don't pay for blood. They also pay for plasma.
That's fascinating to me, by the way, that's in a conversation for another day. But the dual system in Germany, I find just fascinating.
I do too.
Yeah.
And I'm in the middle of trying to get data from Bavaria, because I know I'm chatting with a guy who runs the Red Cross in Bavaria, and he's slowly giving me some of this data. So in Germany, there was a paid blood company that paid people for blood, and then they went under and appeared. And the German Red Cross could only get back, like, 1 out of every 8 of those donors. So that was an instance of an argument in favor of the crowding out hypothesis. Okay. They also conducted surveys in places like New Zealand, where they asked people, like, hey, what if you were offered money? Would you then donate blood more often? And people were like, ew, oh, if you offered me money, then I definitely wouldn't do it. I'd stop donating blood altogether if somebody was being paid for blood. Okay, so that was, like, that survey evidence. And then we had evidence from, like, Czechoslovakia, or the Czech Republic, excuse me. They legalized paying for plasma in 2000. what happened is that plasma donations increased sevenfold, and whole blood donations also increased, but very little. Mm-hmm. So there was a sevenfold increase in plasma donations with basically no impact on blood donations. But this is, again, country level. Now, I've gotten more specific data because one of my students, she's Slovak, and she actually plays basketball for the Slovak national women's team. So I'll be following that team. So we can at least agree to root for that.
We can agree on
team.
That. We'll both root for her. Okay.
So she wrote to the people in charge of the blood system in the Czech Republic and got me all of this more fine-grained data. And so I'm able to say that not only this sevenfold increase in plasma donations happened both for the paid plasma sector as well as the unpaid plasma sector.
Huh.
So an unpaid plasma increased.
Yeah, right.
Okay. And then Bill English and I got data for Canada and the United States. Okay. And in the amount of time that, like, so what we looked at is the period from, I think it was 2014 until about 2018 or 2019. Mm-hmm. That's the time frame when in Canada, three different centers started paid plasma operations. Mm-hmm. There was one in Saskatoon, one in Moncton, New Brunswick, and then there was a center that operated in Winnipeg since like 1984, but they used to only collect specialty plasma. Mm-hmm. But in 2017, they started collecting all plasma types and they paid for plasma. And then interestingly, in the data that we got from the United States, there were also three cities that saw the introduction of paid plasma in the presence of ongoing unpaid blood donations. And what we found is that in Canada, every additional 100 plasma collections were correlated with 8 to 10 additional blood donations.
Huh.
Additional blood donations. In the United States, we saw the direction of the effect was the same, but it was much smaller, meaning that like for every 1,000 additional plasma donations, there were like an extra, I think, 12 or 16 blood donations.
And so do you guys have an explanation for what might be driving that?
We have a couple of possibilities. Mm-hmm. One is an advertising spillover effect. That's the one that we're going with. So the paper is under review at the moment. It's available publicly on ssrn.com, but it is under review at the moment. One hypothesis that we have, the one that we think has the most going for it, is an advertising spillover effect. And it goes like this. If you allow paid plasma, that company is going to advertise.
Right.
But the vast majority of people, when you say, hey, don't donate plasma, they go, yeah, blood.
Uh-huh. Right.
Right. And it's like, well, plasma is different from blood. And people go, yeah. Isn't plasma a part of blood? Yes, right. It's a part of blood, but it's different.
Right.
So if you're on the bus and you see a sign that says, sell your plasma, $20, $50, whatever, every time you sell your plasma, some people sitting on that bus go, oh, yeah, right. There's a Red Cross blood drive. I should probably give blood. That's our hypothesis.
And is that because, so just to try to get to figure out what we think is operating and psychologically here, is it just that, that people are confused? They show up to donate blood thinking they're going to get paid? Or is it just that it makes them aware, blood donation, I should do that?
I think it's the latter and not the former.
Okay.
I think confusion plays some role, but I don't think people who go to the Red Cross, I've not heard of people being like, where's my payment?
Where's my money? Right.
Yeah. Where's my money? I think it's just like raising awareness. Another possibility is like the more people that are giving either blood or plasma in an area, the more likely it is that you'll hear about it.
Yeah.
The more likely it is that you'll know somebody who either sells their plasma or gives blood.
Right.
And then you're just more, your awareness level is raised, then you go, oh yeah, sure, I'll go do that.
Right.
I have a different hypothesis, which has to do with fear, which does not appear in our paper, but it's in the back of my mind, which is there are some people who are just afraid of needles.
Yeah.
But the more people that you know that give blood or plasma, the less afraid you are, I think. And so maybe that'll get you to donate blood.
That sounds plausible to me. Yeah. Yeah.
We have to investigate these things.
Yeah. Right. Well, interesting. Okay. So I guess I I'm trying to think if there was anything else I intended to ask you about the specific case of Canada. Can you bring listeners up to date on where Canada is now in terms of this long and winding road regarding paid plasma donation?
Okay, let me give you a bit of the history too. So yeah. Back in 2012, there was a company called Canadian Plasma Resources, and they announced that they were going to open 10 paid plasma centers across Canada. And that started the debate. People were really, most people were okay with it.
Yeah.
But there was a small group of people who were really not okay with it. And I'll explain why in a bit. So they started operating with 3 plasma centers in the province of Ontario. But by 2014, the Ontario government introduced the Voluntary Blood Donations Act, which made it illegal for them to operate, which made it illegal for any commercial enterprise to pay people for either blood or plasma donations. By the way, they exempted Canadian Blood Services. So it's legal for Canadian Blood Services to pay for plasma.
Okay. But only them.
But only them.
Okay.
So then this company said, okay, we'll go out west. And they opened a plasma center in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. And then they were going to open in Alberta. But by 2017, the Alberta government passed the same law that Ontario passed, making them illegal. So then they opened a plasma center in Moncton, New Brunswick, and then they were going to open in British Columbia, but the British Columbia government passed the same law that Ontario and Alberta passed in 2018. Okay, so we only have 3 paid plasma centers across all of Canada. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, demand for the therapies made from plasma continues to increase at 6 to 10% per year. Mm-hmm. And Canada has gone from being 30% self-sufficient in the plasma that is used to make these therapies. We are now 13.5% self-sufficient. Mm-hmm. The rest we get from American paid donors.
Right.
Okay. However, Alberta had a change of government, and they, as of in July of this year, a private member named Tani Yao introduced the private members bill to repeal the Voluntary Blood Donations Act in Alberta. They are now on break. They resume October 27th. It has gone through second reading in Canada. It has to go through 3 readings before it becomes law. At this point, I am convinced that it will become law by November or December of this year. So Alberta, it will be legal to pay for plasma.
That's great.
And thank goodness.
Yeah, right. So, when you're in these discussions and debates, I know you've had many with folks over the Canadian position. I mean, what is their reaction when you say, but the result of this is that we just buy all of our plasma from the United States where they pay donors? I mean, do they say something like, well, we should stop doing that and try to use less plasma? Or do they just say, yeah, but we don't care about Americans? I mean, which, you know, kudos to them for being honest about it. I mean, but what is their reaction?
So one reaction is to try to say, oh, well, what happens in America? Like, who knows? That's America's business. That's not our business, right?
Right.
But I'm like, well, if paying people for plasma is exploitative, then we are participating in exploiting Americans, right?
Right.
Okay. They also respond by saying, so Canadian Blood Services has put forward a proposal to open 40 unpaid plasma centers, and they have asked for $855 million in order to be able to do that. And so they say, we need to give Canadian Blood Services time to open those 40 plasma centers. That will, according to Canadian Blood Services, that will hopefully result in 50% self-sufficiency in just one of these therapies, immune globulin, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the hope. Mm-hmm. And so they say we need to give them time to do that. How much time?
Right.
Is my response.
Right.
Separately, I say the average unpaid plasma center collects between 10,000 to like 30,000 liters of plasma per year. Compared to 20,000, mm-hmm. 10 to 20,000 liters per year. The average paid plasma center in the United States collects 60,000 liters per year. The numbers are so different.
Yeah, right.
Canadian Blood Services wants to have an ongoing operational budget of $247 million. and they want to collect 600,000 liters of plasma at full maturity.
Right.
Well, I crunched the numbers. That's $412 per liter collected.
Right, right.
The private Canadian company has offered all of its plasma to Canadian Blood Services at $220 per liter. That's the most recent offer.
Right, right.
It's 2 to 4 times more expensive. Yeah. It's less than half as like efficient or productive.
Yeah.
There's no difference in safety or effectiveness. There is no impact on unpaid blood donations. It just seems absurd to spend twice as much.
Right.
We have other healthcare priorities we should be spending money on.
Especially now.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So this actually kind of brings me to a similar question about WHO, which I find do you have any insight into their position? And I mean, let's just assume that it made sense at the time, right? But now, right? And I mean, they have the same position on blood. I'm gonna, you know, as I already said, Nico and Mario will be on, and we'll talk about whether that makes sense. But plasma strikes me as being just much less defensible for precisely the reasons that you've laid out, including that if I understand you right, there is no country that is self-sufficient in plasma who doesn't pay. And unlike blood,
yeah.
Unlike blood, right? And so it's, what are they thinking?
okay. I'm speculating again.
Of course.
I have much better insight into the motives and the reasons that people who oppose paid plasma in Canada, why they oppose it. I have much less when it comes to the World Health Organization. I haven't spoken with them. Okay, so one theory that I have is that this is a theory that I've heard both from American blood clinic operators and Canadian blood clinic operators, which is a story about the fragility of the culture of altruism. Mm-hmm. So in order to get enough blood for transfusion or whatever, we need to have a system where we reward and applaud pure altruism. Mm-hmm. But altruistic culture is so fragile, especially in the face of commodification. Mm-hmm. And so if we allow a little bit of commodification into the system, we're going to have to commodify the whole thing because the whole culture of altruism is going to fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I think the World Health Organization believes that, by the way, there is a condition where some people have too much iron in their blood. I forget what it's called, hemochromatosis or something
I forget it too, but I have read about it, yeah.
So the American Red Cross, if they find out you have that condition, will not allow you to donate blood. One thing that you can do if you have this condition, to fix this condition, is to donate blood. It's good for you. It's a win-win, right? But the American Red Cross is like, well, but if you donate blood, then it's not pure altruism. You're doing it for this, like, this is, to me, this is such extremism. It just kind of points to this, like, the concern about the culture of altruism, that it's so fragile that we can't have people benefit from donating blood. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. Here's another theory that somebody has told me about with respect to the World Health Organization, which is this. If they allow paid plasma, or if they augment their position with respect to paid plasma, then the low and middle income countries, where I would not recommend a paid plasma system because they do not have the safety technology, they do not have the like advanced testing, and they don't have those procedures in place.
Right.
Then they're just going to be like, well, then we can pay for blood and we can pay for plasma. And so in order to keep some of the poorer countries from changing those policies, the World Health Organization has adopted, as though like everybody listens to the World Health Organization, which not everybody does, but they have adopted this extreme position to prevent what they imagine would be a repeat of the tainted blood scandal.
Right.
So those are, the culture of altruism is super fragile, theory number one. Theory number two is like, if you allow paid plasma in advanced countries, then developing nations will respond by paying for blood.
Both of those sound plausible to me, and consistent with WHO positions with respect to organ donation and organ trafficking, for example, right? Which is, not to get too much into it, but there is definitely this notion that things have to be resisted, not because they are in and of themselves dangerous, but because they might lead to organ trafficking. In particular, it might lead to poor countries saying, hey, well, you know, if the US can do this thing and it's, you know, kind of just like a market, then why can't we just have a market here? And it resonates with sort of their position on organ donation. And again, the preservation of altruism, and then also organ trafficking, this worry, right, that other countries will copy the developed countries, but do it badly, essentially. And that motivates much of what seemed like extreme positions, as you say. So that, I mean, you know, even though we're just speculating, it does sound consistent to me with what one sees in regards to organ donation. As well.
The best I can do. I've written, and I'm trying to have a conversation with somebody at the World Health Organization about this, but they are a kind of distant, non-transparent kind of organization. I have no idea how to even begin to talk to them. As compared to like Canadian Blood Services, I've had conversations with Graham Schur. You know, I can talk to like people at the American Red Cross. But the World Health Organization is like an impenetrable, they might as well be on Mars as far as I'm concerned.
Right. okay. So, I mean, this is most of what I wanted to talk to you about. Have I forgotten some big thing that we should have discussed and we failed to? I mean,
there's one thing that is worth asking about, which is why is it that in the United States, there is no like organized opposition to paid plasma?
That's a great question. I wish I had thought of that.
how come in America people are like paid plasma? Yeah, of course.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But in Canada there is this like organized opposition to it. So why is there this difference? So the first thing that I will say is there have been three separate public opinion surveys of Canadians at large about payment for plasma. And all three of them find that overwhelming majorities of Canadians are A-okay with like paying for plasma. One of those surveys was conducted by Nico Lachitera
and Mario. I haven't seen the other two, I don't think. Were they?
The other one was conducted by Canadian Blood Services. And the only thing that they will release publicly is that majorities and 7 out of 10 young people were in favor of payment for plasma. And then the third one was conducted by myself. So I did a survey of Canadians, and we found that like 63% of Canadians are okay. Think that paying for plasma is morally appropriate.
Okay.
That's the question, morally appropriate.
Appropriate, right.
You can see those at donationethics.com.
Okay.
All right, so why is there this difference between the US and Canada? The answer is that in Canada, the employees of Canadian Blood Services are represented by public sector employees' unions.
Okay.
And private commercial paid plasma centers represent competition to Canadian Blood Services. If we allow a commercial sector, then there will be less pressure on provincial governments to give money to Canadian Blood Services to open more unpaid plasma collection centers, right? So they have, and back in 2012, Canadian Blood Services shuttered a plasma collection center in Thunder Bay because they were collecting like 6,000 liters of plasma per year. But that meant that these people lost their jobs. So the public sector unions are the ones that have pushed this opposition. They fund all of the major organizations that oppose paid plasma in Canada. I have found no organization that isn't funded by them.
You're kidding. I didn't know that.
Some of them are not secret, like Canadian Health Coalition is founded and funded by public sector unions. Friends of Medicare, also like funded by public sector unions. And then Blood Watch is like the major organization, and they're super secret about where they get their funding. But, you know, if you Google, quote, contribution to Blood Watch, end quote, you'll find like meetings of the Ontario Public Service Employees Union where they're like, we're going to give $20,000 to Blood Watch, we're going to give $10,000 to Blood Watch, and so on. So they fund So that's where the
opposition comes. For people who are listening and not watching, I'm sitting here with my mouth hanging open because I'm in shock by this. I mean, that's amazing. So is it all just hand waving, all the safety and commodification and crowding out? I mean, is it just about, is it all fake? I mean,
Is it all fake? I want to be as charitable as possible. So I will say that for a lot of participants in this debate,
they believe it.
And I mean, like, so the president of the Ontario Public Service Employees Union keeps saying that, like, oh, safety. That guy doesn't know what he's talking about. That guy clearly is just interested in preserving jobs. He's doing his job, right? He represents the union.
Right, right.
He wants to increase the number of people that they represent. So he's, okay, there are, however, at least a few people who are sincere. I've had conversations with them. We have good, healthy back and forths. There are professors who are on the other side of this debate. It took them a while. So I should say, like, I have never been paid by anyone in the plasma industry. I have never received, I don't own any shares in any of these companies, even though, like, I wish I did. Whether Canada legalizes it or not, it has no impact on, like, my financial, I have no financial stake in this whatsoever. However, in this debate, like, publicly, people are often just saying that I get paid by, like, the plasma industry or whatever. This is actually what led me to, like, look into Blood Watches. I'm like, who cares that Blood Watch gets its money from the unions? If the argument is good, the argument stands on its own. But I noticed that, like, the arguments were not that good.
Yeah, right.
And then the ones that I'm like, oh, well, this is false. Like, the CEO of Canadian Blood Services said this is false. Why do you keep saying it? And then they kept accusing me of taking money from them. So I was like, okay, well, you know, let's look under that rock.
And that's right.
That's what I found. But there are plenty of people on the other side of this debate who are very sincere, who believe in, like, the fragility of the culture of altruism.
Yes.
Who believe that, like, the way we shouldn't get this product is altruistically. They think that, like, well, what about the space for altruism? Like, if we get rid of this space, we'll have fewer opportunities for altruistic expression, although you can always just hug more people, I guess. Not in coronavirus.
Not now, but yeah.
They have some genuine worries about, like, really poor people are going to do this. So there are plenty of people who have good objections.
So I guess I should clarify that I was not suggesting that there aren't genuine arguments that one can make on the other side and that all the people that make them don't believe them, but that the specific actors within the debate overpaying in Canada were perhaps being disingenuous. And if that's the case, I find it less mysterious. I mean, actually, because, I mean, now I understand it.
There's a good bootleggers and Baptists story here.
Story. Right? Yeah, right, right, right. Well, thank you so much, Peter, for being on today. I learned a lot, and I'm glad we finally got to have this conversation because we talk on email and Twitter, but it's been a few years since I got to talk to you in person, and this is what passes for in person now. So,
well, I want to thank you very much for having me on, for giving me an opportunity to talk about this really important issue. I did want to close by saying that we are anticipating a shortage of plasma therapies by the end of this year or early next year because there was a 15 to 20% decrease in the amount of plasma donations in the United States. I think that's something that a lot of us should be concerned about. I suspect at least one of your students has a condition that, you know, that either they themselves use plasma therapies or they have friends who use plasma therapies. Yeah. So I think it's really important for other countries to step up and start collecting plasma before something really bad happens. But anyways, Kim, thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.
Yeah, last time we saw each other was in person, was at Georgetown University. I also want to end with Julia Saxa.
Ah!
That's a basketball thing.
Go Heels!